Dear friends, thank you very much for inviting me. It's nice to be in Vancouver on a sunny day. Because I was telling friends here that every other time I've been to this city, it's been raining. And when people point out it's really very beautiful, it's great, I'd never quite believed it, but today I do. Let's see what has changed in the world since we last met. And that means starting with a war which people would like to forget. And I've just got here from a nearly two and a half week tour of the United States. And there were very large audiences. But the feeling overall you got in the United States was that this was a country which did not know it was at war. And the way that war is portrayed in the media is very episodic. And unlike 30 years ago, when the entire country knew they were fighting a war in Vietnam, like it or not, this time there is passivity, there is demoralization because of Bush's re-election, and you don't get the feeling that people are really aware that it's a war and that US troops should be withdrawn immediately from Iraq. I hope it'll pick up, but certainly that was one of the themes that we discussed in the United States. Now, the way the war in Iraq is being presented today, they failed in everything else. All the reasons that they gave for the war have now been conclusively proved, and it has been demonstrated that they were lies. That the leaders of the Western world who supported the war lied. And the reason they lied was to convince their publics that it was essential to go to war. So having failed to convince people with all the lies, what they are now saying is, ah, yes, but we have introduced freedom and democracy to Iraq. So let's discuss freedom and democracy in Iraq and what state we are at. First, Iraq is a country under occupation. Hundreds of thousands of foreign soldiers litter the streets of most of its cities. These soldiers come largely from the United States and Britain. The third largest force in Iraq are what in the old days we would describe quite bluntly as mercenaries. But in today's world, where language itself has become debased, they are referred to as defense contractors. But these defense contractors are essentially privatized soldiers, mercenaries, hired by the United States to make up for the default in its own army. They need more soldiers, but there's a decline in recruitment because it's a volunteer army now. It's not an army which has been recruited by a draft through conscription. And so they depend on people to join the army. And since the war in Iraq began, recruitment figures have fallen drastically for the land army, for the US Army. For the Air Force, they're still pretty high. But people don't want to go and get killed. They don't mind killing from the air when no one can touch you because no one else has that air power. But once you invade a country and occupy it, you can get killed, as they're finding out. So recruitment is right down. And so the contradiction of the United States is how to hold Iraq with such a small force. They never thought it would be small, but it has now, it looks very tiny compared to the population of that country. And mercenaries aren't capable of doing the trick. And they go far afield to recruit mercenaries. A US sergeant 6 or 7 months ago was captured by the Nepalese guerrillas and held captive. And they said, what are you doing in our country? And he said, I'm here to recruit people for the Iraq war. They said, you're very lucky we're going to let you go. You have no business being here. They recruit from South Africa. I don't know how many of you know that there are dozens of South African whites from the old torture brigades of the apartheid regime who are now fighting in Iraq. One of them, I was in South Africa about 8 months ago, One of them, who participated in the torture and killing of Steve Biko, had been killed in Iraq. And I remember some South African friends saying to me, thank God the Iraqis don't believe in truth and reconciliation. Someone's dealt with this guy. So the question is, can they carry on in this fashion? And a lot will depend now on what happens over the next 6 months. So you have a half-baked, rushed election in which no one who publicly demands the withdrawal of United States troops and the occupation armies from Iraq is allowed to appear on television. The Shia parties or the Shia blocs that won the election were forced to give a press conference before these elections to say that they were not in favor of a US withdrawal. The Kurdish tribal leaders publicly said they want the United States to stay. Now, what is strange about this is that the Shia bloc, which participated in an election under an occupation, hoping this way to come to power, which they have, but its power very restricted, because the only force in the country which defends that power is an occupying force. So it's limited. But they know one thing perfectly well, that the overwhelming bulk of the Iraqi population wants an end to the occupation. So 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks ago, you had the largest mass gathering in Iraq for 30 years. You had over 250,000 people marching in the central square in Baghdad, demanding an end to the occupation and burning effigies of Bush and Blair. So what price an election designed to supposedly stabilize a country? That's the question we have to ask. And in my opinion, it is not going to stabilize the country. And the reason it isn't going to stabilize the country is because the country is occupied. Just imagine if during the occupation of France by the Germans during the Second World War, when actually there was more support for the Germans in France than there is for the United States in Iraq, if the truth be told, at least 50, if not 60% of the French population went along with the occupation because they weren't particularly affected by it initially. And it took the French resistance 3 years to grow, and it was created by the British as part of the fight of the Second World War between the different powers. In Iraq, no outside power intervened to form the resistance. It was an internal resistance, and it grew up very quickly. But just suppose that the Germans had organized a referendum, which was their favored method in those days, and the bulk of French people had voted for a German occupation in that referendum. Who would have taken it seriously? Even though it would have been probably much more serious than anything in Iraq today. So one has to look at these things both in historical perspective and what it means concretely to be an occupied country and how you react when you are an occupied country. And the fact is that unlike the German occupation in France, for most people, not Jews and communists, but for most people, the system worked. Everything was fine, food was available, the cafes functioned, the theaters were there, the cinema was there, more movies were made. In Iraq, nothing functions. Nothing functions. The electricity doesn't function in many cities, the water supply has been cut off, the hospitals don't have enough medicines. The situation is chaotic, and it's a savage chaos. And the only thing which seems to function as before is the Abu Ghraib prison, where tortures carry on. And one awaits for some warmonger ideologue in the West, and I'm sure it will happen, because politics these days outpaces satire. I'm sure we will soon have a book from someone, probably some well-paid academic on an American campus, who will write on how democratic torture is in fact more advanced than totalitarian torture. wait for it. It will happen. It will happen. Because in behind the scenes, these debates are taking place in the American Academy. And if you look at the time it took, these professors, you know, there's a new development on the American Academy, in the American Academy. Don't let them mimic it here, by the way, unless it's already happened. But a new post has sprung up, which is professors for human rights studies. And 90% of these professors for human rights studies tend to be those who support US wars abroad. So the linkage between human rights and US wars abroad is very clear. They defend them, they justify them, they've become their ideologues. They were posed a problem when the tortures at Abu Ghraib became very public. What to do? Because it takes even a human rights professor appointed by the academy a bit of time to work out some explanation for this. Because human rights here are being clearly violated. And they hummed, and they hawed, and there was a lot of hand-wringing that went on. And finally, after 2 weeks of serious thought, Michael Ignatieff came out with an article on the New York Times op-ed page saying it was difficult to justify these tortures. Well, thank you. So this is the world in which we live, where US power is so strong that it affects the ideology in a very, very sharp way, much more so than it did in the past when you had a diverse world. In the 60s and 70s, in the early 80s, you had a world in which you had different states with different social systems, which may have been defective in many ways, but which at least enabled a large margin of space to exist. Today, that world is gone. You have capitalism in virtually every other country of the world, in every country of the world, with the exception of Cuba and partially Venezuela, where a new process is beginning. But in this situation, the ideologues also have become much more shrill because they feel they don't have to debate with anyone. And the effect that this has had on the media of the Western world is very noticeable. I don't live in this country and don't visit it that often, so I can't comment on it, but some of you may do so. But I visit the United States a great deal, and I spend a lot of time in Britain. And there you see very clearly what has been happening. That in the United States now, within the mainstream media, there is no diversity allowed. No anti-war voices are permitted. Forget Fox television. People sometimes say to me, if the Third Reich had a television system, would it be like Fox? And I said no, because they were better propagandists, the Germans. They wouldn't be so crude. I don't talk about Fox. I talk about the mainstream networks and the stuff they churn out. And it's frightening. It's frightening. And this is the reason why in the United States there's been a gut response from a minority to produce alternatives. This is why Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! Is heard and watched by 2 million Americans every morning, all over the United States, and it's going up slowly, because she presents an alternative view, which even people who might not agree with everything on her program want to hear that opinion so they can make up their minds. And in Britain, what did we see? We saw a rigged judicial inquiry into the Iraq war, where they appointed a bent judge, who produced a bent report. They used the bent report to attack the BBC for its coverage of the war, and Tony Blair personally authorized the sacking of the chairman of the Board of Governors and the Director General of the BBC, both new Labour appointments, because they had let the government down in their reporting of the Iraq war. And the Director General of the BBC has now written his memoirs. He's, you know, he's not a bad guy, but he is illiterate. But he can't write particularly well. But there are some gems in that book. And one of the gems is his exchange with Blair, when Downing Street in the run-up to the war was ringing him up every day. and saying, why have you got this? Why have you got X? Why is a current affairs show got audiences which are totally anti-war? And he would reply, because that's all who, you know, applies to come to these things. So they then went and found him tame Iraqis to put in these audiences who would defend the war. And when the big demonstration in London took place, and 1.5 million people marched through the streets, the biggest demonstration in British history, and the BBC was reporting it 24 hours coverage from the beginning to the end of the demonstration, and some of us were interviewed for 20, 25 minutes on this live television program, Downing Street, we later found out, was on the phone 5 times that day with Blair's head of press saying, the BBC is reporting 1 million people on the march. How do you know? Have you counted them? And the director general of the BBC says, no, we haven't counted them, but this is the official police figure. So ring up Scotland Yard if you want to have the figures rigged. The demonstrators are claiming 1.5 million. I'm just pointing this out to you as examples of how desperately important the media has become for them. Because most ordinary people these days do not get their information even from the print media. They get it largely from television. So the wars that we see have also become wars of images. And that is why, when the United States is about to fight a war, they prepare plans for targeting television stations that might report news which doesn't tally with the mainstream images being presented to the Western public. And you have the way they bombed the Al Jazeera offices in Kabul at the beginning of the Afghan war, the targeting of Tariq Ayub, the chief Al Jazeera correspondent in Baghdad, the week the occupation began. And you can see on the screen, some of you may have seen it in this excellent documentary called The Control Room, of the guys reporting from the top of a roof, and a helicopter comes and fires missiles at him, deliberately to kill him, which they succeed in doing. And more recently, an Al Jazeera reporter was picked up simply because he was an Al Jazeera reporter, taken into Abu Ghraib prison and tortured. Why? Why are they so obsessed with it? Because they know that the wars they fight are being fought on extremely flimsy grounds. And if alternative images of what these wars are doing get out, there will be an outcry. So the key thing is to keep the population depoliticized. Don't show it images which get it worked up, unless these images are used to get people worked up to participate in and support a war. So they can be very partial. I give you another example. About 2 months ago, 2.5 months ago, I was in Qatar, tiny Arab state, which has two tourist attractions. One is Al Jazeera television, and the other is the Al Adid base, the largest US military base in the world. They're about 5 miles from each other. So I was talking to the general manager of Al Jazeera, and I said, what are the pressures on you guys? Because, you know, some of your reporting is quite amazing. Does the government here... He said, the government doesn't interfere. They let us get on with it. So I said, what happens then? He said, well, you know, 2 weeks ago, one of our crews in Iraq, and we have 18 crews in Iraq reporting every day. One of our crews in Baghdad captured an image of an American tank commander firing on a car, and he carried on filming, and he got the images, and the car was burnt, and in the car, sitting in the front, were the mother and father, and in the back were 3 children. They were all killed. So he said it was a horrific but very important story of what is actually happening on the streets in Baghdad. And we know, he said to me, from CNN and BBC World, these images aren't reported. They aren't even shot in most cases. So we led our news bulletins with it. He said after the second news bulletin went out, someone came running and said that the commander of the US military base, General X, with an armored convoy of three carriers, has just entered the Al Jazeera compound and he's marching straight to your office. So he said he walked into my office. I said, "Hi, General, how are you? Sit down. What can we do for you?" And he said, "I've just seen these images you put out on Al Jazeera. And it's images like these that are creating anti-Americanism in the world." So the boss of Al Jazeera said, he said, "General, with great respect," he's a very calm guy, he never loses his cool. He said, "With great respect, do ask yourself, is it the images that are creating it or what you're actually doing? Just think about it for a bit." And the general said, "Yes, but you know, of course it happened, I don't doubt that. But did you know what was in the mind of the tank commander? Did you report what he was thinking when he did that?" So the guy said, "No, how can we tell what's in the mind of people? You know, we're not mind readers." And the general said, "He obviously thought that this car was packed with terrorists. And you should have reported it, that this was a terrible tragedy in an accident because the American tank commander thought he was firing on terrorists." So the guy said, quietly, he said, "We let CNN do that." And the general then said, "I demand an apology." And the Al Jazeera guy said, "General, if we're talking about apologies, then we need one from you, because what you've been doing to us now for the last 5 years, killing our people, bombing our headquarters, and when you apologize to us in public, then you come back and we'll discuss anything else." And at this point, the general said, "I don't know about these events." He told his deputy officer, "You take this down," and walked out. And I just carry on stressing this to you to show how important the role of the media has become. It's become, even more than ever before, a central ideological pillar of the war regime. They cannot do without it. And therefore, fighting for space within the mainstream media, I mean, it's a task which has to be carried on. But it's increasingly being narrowed down. And I'm prepared to bet it's not so different in Canada either. It's a general pattern now, which we see in the advanced Western world. There was a limited period in the run-up to the war where they were beginning to allow voices because of the millions who came out on the streets. They couldn't totally deny us a presence. But now it's back to normal as they try and present a situation in Iraq as it's virtually normal. You know, there's an elected government, it'll be like any other country very soon. Well, it won't be as long as the United States stay there. And the big debate which is going on in the United States within the anti-war movement between the more liberal elements and the more left-wing elements is the following. They all want a withdrawal, but the more liberal elements within the anti-war movement says, however, there is a point in what our leaders say when they say if we were to leave now, there would be a mess. To which I replied, you go in and invade a country, you occupy it, you create a big mess, you try and divide the country along ethnic grounds, constantly talking about Shia and Sunna and Sunna and Shia and Kurds, talk of this sort which had now not been heard in Iraq before under any government. You go in and do that, you cannot stabilize the country, you cannot even stabilize the green zone in Baghdad where all of the top people live. Recently, some US congressmen went into that green zone and were told, you can't sleep here tonight because it's not safe. And if you were killed, it would be an awful propaganda blow. And one of these congressmen describes how even when he went to use the toilet, some Marines went with him, which couldn't have been a pleasant experience. So they cannot even secure the green zone in Baghdad. And Baghdad is a city of 6 to 7 million people, a sprawling metropolis like Los Angeles. And it's a mixed city, Sunnah, Shia, Kurd, Christian, they all live there. They can't maintain stability even in one city. And if and when sections of the Shia bloc break, as I predict they will, sooner rather than later, then they will not be able to control the southern cities either. So what's this talk about? If we leave, there'll be a mess. You go in, you create a mess, and you say, we can't leave because if we leave, there will be a mess. It's a circular argument. It's true it's not going to be easy for the Iraqis, given this scale of destruction. But they will manage, because Iraq, unlike many other countries in that region, was an extremely well-educated country in terms of the level of culture. You had vast numbers of engineers, doctors, architects. Saddam had many vices. He was a brutal tyrant in many ways in terms of political repression, in terms of social welfare, and the education of women and men from poor families, that went ahead. So Iraq has a big, big reservoir of skilled and very advanced skilled labor. They can reconstruct their country themselves. They're not that keen on Halliburton and Bechtel to come in and do it for them. In fact, they don't want these companies, which is why many of these companies are being targeted as well. As a statement by Iraqis, we don't want you here. And where is the oil? When Wolfowitz, now the president of the World Bank, appropriate position, was asked, how will you fund this war? Because the last time you took out Iraq, because it intervened in Kuwait, you got money from the Arab states. The Saudis more or less paid for the war. No one's paying it this time. How are you going to fund it, given the state of the U.S. economy? And both Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld replied, think about this. The sales of Iraqi oil will help us to fund the war. So you take a country, you take its oil, you sell it, and you think that that oil will fund the war. But they haven't been able to get the oil wells working. Over the last 18 months, I think there have been up to 1,800 or 1,900 attacks on the oil pipelines. They can't keep them going. And that is an indication of how deep this business goes. Now, people ask, what are the similarities with Vietnam? And since it was 30 years ago this weekend that those amazing images of the US fleeing Saigon and people clinging onto the helicopters startled the world, because it was the first time an imperial power, the United States as an imperial power, had been humiliated in public. That's what had happened. Now, that's what had happened, and people had said that could never happen, but that had happened 30 years ago today. So what are the similarities with Vietnam? There aren't all that many analogies, and I'll tell you why. A, we live in a different epoch. It is not the epoch of the 20th century. It's a different epoch that we live in. Secondly, the Iraqi resistance, unlike the Vietnamese resistance, is not a unified resistance. The Vietnamese had a unified armed and a political resistance, which functioned globally. Everything they did, everything was targeted at American public opinion, and they were very successful at that. Very successful. In this case, that is not so. The resistance comes from different political currents of thought. There is a strong religious component to it. They are not unified. It's decentralized. There are advantages in that, that it becomes impossible in a way to crush them because no one knows who or where they are. The one thing we do know, which I would advise you all to be very careful about, is that the presentation by the Western media of this tiny group led by Abu Musa al-Zarqawi is very suspicious and dodgy. And very few Iraqis believe in this group. Most of them hate it, and most of them regard it as a group of provocateurs. And what makes it even more difficult is that the real Zarqawi is supposed to be dead. Guy in his late 50s with one leg, who was a deputy of Osama bin Laden. And the Zarqawi presented on the television screens is a sprightly 30-year-old, who, rumor has it, used to work for Jordanian intelligence. And given that Jordan is basically an Israeli-US protectorate at the moment, it does make you think of what is going on. So I would not take any of the writings on this guy seriously. If Zarqawi was the only force in the country, we would be in real trouble. The fact is there is a very deep, unarmed and armed resistance which takes place in Iraq, and despite its weaknesses, it has prevented the United States from claiming the war as a triumph. Because despite the images you use, despite the elections, the casualty figures continue to rise. The proportion of deaths now, that is roughly the equivalent of Vietnam. When the United States left Vietnam, the death toll was 50,000 US soldiers and 2 million Vietnamese. The recent figures, 1,600 US soldiers and 100,000 plus Iraqis. So the proportions are the same, not so different. And that in itself is interesting. And even this level of resistance, the United States will not be able to crush without sending in 250,000 more troops. And that is impossible unless they introduce the draft. And any president who introduces the draft is signing the death warrant of his own political party. That, too, we know from history. So it's a very awkward situation for the United States, and it's a very desperate situation for Iraq. Secondly, I think it's important to understand that in an otherwise grim world, the continent, which is in open rebellion now against neoliberal capitalist politics and against US policies on that continent, is Latin America. This is extremely important to grasp because it's not reported regularly, and this too has been misreported. First, in every single Latin American country today, you have a large social movement which is challenging World Bank, IMF, capitalist politics in that region. Whether it's the large social movement in Bolivia fighting against privatization, the Peruvian peasantry which resisted and won a battle against privatizing electricity, whether it's the native populations of Ecuador demanding a say in how the state is governed, whether it's the population of Uruguay defeating a neoliberal president, whether it's the landless peasants in Brazil in their millions refusing to give up on the struggle for land, whether it's the mayor of Mexico fighting against a corrupt regime backed by the United States and looks likely to win the next presidential elections. And of course, at the apex of this movement is the success achieved by the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, where after three attempts, three attempts by the United States to overthrow that regime failed. And the last time they tried it, the masses came out into the street in millions to put Chavez back into power, and the soldiers mutinied. They mutinied. And the story of that mutiny is a wonderful story. because it restores all one's faith in the capacity of human beings and political consciousness to change. Because political consciousness is not something which is stable or static or linear. It goes up and down in waves. And what happened in Venezuela when the United States organized coup had taken place, the generals who organized the coup, 1 year before they went to war in Iraq, because Venezuela is also an oil-rich country, and they wanted to grab it. Power had been taken away from the oligarchy, and they wanted to give the oligarchs back the power. So it was such a crude maneuver. And Chavez had been elected, not once, but four times in different ways. And when they overthrew him, they found the most corrupt businessman in the country and were swearing him in as president when the mutinies within the army started. And how we found out was that the general organizing the coup brought this, said came out of the Miraflores Palace, Chavez was being arrested at a military base, and said to the band which plays the music and the national anthem, he said to them, the entire Western media is here to see our new president being sworn in, and when I bring him out, you must play the national anthem. And these ordinary soldiers in the band in their 20s said, what new president general? We elected Chavez. Well, where is he? So the general said, you don't join the army to ask questions. I'm just telling you there is a new president, and when I bring him out, you'll play the national anthem. And the soldiers asked three times the name of the new president. Finally, he gave it, and they started muttering to each other. Then he turned to a 17-year-old bugler who plays the trumpet whenever the president comes out on state occasions, and said to him, and you, boy, when I bring the new president out, you will play the trumpet to announce him. Can't you see all these television cameras are here? And this 17-year-old soldier asks the general, what new president general? Because we elected Hugo Chavez. And the general tells him three times, you will obey orders or you will be dealt with. And this young soldier takes the bugle and says, general, you seem really keen that someone plays the bugle. Here, you play it. Now, ask yourselves, what gives a 17-year-old soldier from a poor peasant family the guts and the consciousness to challenge his general? And what gives him that guts is that for the first time he knows, because he's in touch with his family, that this is a government which is trying to do things for us, for the poor, for our class, for the shanty towns, for the poor peasants without land, for the slum dwellers in Caracas. They're using oil money to build schools, to build homes, to give us deeds to the land which we squat. No other government has ever done that. So the coup failed and Chavez came back in triumph. And then there was, like in Chile against Allende, a middle class strike of doctors and teachers trying to paralyze the system. And they said to each other, we will see how, now that the breweries are closed, how long the shanty towns will love Chavez. And Chavez told me a story the last time I met him. He said even more than the coup, it was the strike of the middle classes that worried me, because I could see our country beginning to disintegrate as we couldn't deliver education or health. And he said, one day I was so depressed, I went into the big shanty towns in Caracas, just with two other people, and started walking around there. And he said, an old woman saw me, and she said, are you Chavez? I said, yeah. She said, come, just come up with me. So she said, she took me by the arm, took me to her slum dwelling, and the family was sitting around a fire in the room, and she was making some soup. And she said, look at my bed, Chavez. I have removed the legs of this bed to use as firewood, because the gas people are on strike, to cook food for my family. And tomorrow I will break the rest of the bed. And the day after, I will burn our table. And the day after that, I will burn the furniture. And then I will go and scour for food, but we don't want you to give up. We don't want you to give up. And he said, as he was walking out, he met a lot of these unemployed youths who came up to him and said, you know, those so-and-sos were saying that we couldn't live without beer. We live without beer. We'll drink our own piss if necessary. You don't give up. You don't give up. And he said that encounter with the poor in that shanty town gave him more courage than anything else. And then he rang up Fidel and said, we need help. And within 3 weeks, 10,000 Cuban doctors with lots of Cuban medicines arrived in Venezuela, set up clinics in the shanty towns and transformed the conditions of people there. Now, what this shows is it can be done if you have politicians with the will to do it. What the reforms that Chavez is pushing through in Venezuela are not all that radical for those of us who grew up in the 60s. But in today's world, they offer a big, big challenge to the world of neoliberalism. And so the whole of Latin America now has become polarized between Chavez and Lula. Lula, who accepts the IMF and what it demands, and Chavez, who does not. And the Venezuelans are saying to other governments in Latin America, let us create a Bolivarian federation in the whole of Latin America. We will help you with the oil. We will give you cheap oil to transform your countries so that we are in a better position to confront the United States. Because unless you have the support of your populations, it is not possible to confront the United States successfully. And he said, in Venezuela, we are ready in waiting. If they ever come, whether through Colombia or through somewhere else, we are not going to be defeated ever again by them. And I give you these examples to show that sometimes in North America, which is a very large continent, even in Canada, one can get cut off from the rest of the world. But it's a large, large world out there. And a lot of what is happening in different parts, especially in Latin America, are extremely encouraging. So if you look at it from that point of view, in Iraq, they've had a big series of setbacks. They are not going to be able to pull things together. In Palestine, they thought, the Israelis and the United States, that the main task of Abu Mazen, who succeeded Arafat, would be to propel him and push him in the direction of launching a Palestinian civil war by saying, you have got to get rid of Hamas, kill them if necessary, before we really do business with you. It's not going to happen, because even Abu Mazen, he wants to please them, but if he does that, he will lose his entire base or a large bulk of it. And to what should he kill Hamas for? What for? So they disengage from Gaza? So what? Gaza will just become a giant labor camp, which will be used for ferrying cheap labor to and from Israel with strict restrictions. That's what it will become. You will not have a Palestinian state. And increasingly now, Palestinians are realizing, if we can't get an independent state, which is a genuine state with contiguous borders, all we get is shriveled little Bantustans. If that's all on offer, let's go for a unified Israel-Palestine with equal rights for Jews and non-Jews in a unified state. But the but the Zionist establishment will not accept that either. Because the mentality they have is many, many brave Israelis are beginning to point out, but not journalists in North America or even Europe, that Israel is essentially run as an apartheid state. It's run as an apartheid state, and the laws which are imposed on its population, the social laws, are extremely reactionary, which people don't think about. You know, often they're so obsessed with attacking Islam and backward Islam and this, that, and the other, and you have people writing idiotic books called The Trouble with Islam, And all this nonsense goes on in order to try and please the people in power. That's the function of books like that. But recently a group of Israeli filmmakers have made films on the conditions of women in Israel. And there was a showing of them in London recently, and I went with large numbers of people from the Jewish community in London. And it is more difficult for an Israeli woman to get a divorce than it is for most Muslim women in most parts of the Muslim world, with obvious exceptions like Saudi Arabia. It's even easier for an Iranian woman to get a divorce in Iran than it is for an Israeli woman to get a divorce. People are shocked when you say this. The film shows it all. Religious laws are in place. Unless the husband agrees, the woman will not get a divorce. And many, many guys keep their women hanging on. They have the right to have other women, but if the woman does, she's punished. And the judges are completely part of this whole scheme. So even the picture you get of what happens inside Israel is a very limited picture. And that's not a model we want for a proper state. But those are the two choices. Either a unified state with equal rights and not ruled by the religious laws of any religious group, or an independent Palestine and an Israeli retreat to the 67 frontiers. They are not prepared to accept either of these positions. So they leave the Palestinians with little option but to carry on the struggle, even in these horrible conditions of defeat. And this is the world we live in, and this is a world which is rarely reported, especially in the Western media, where any criticism of Israel is now regarded as anti-Semitic. Why? Because before they went into Jenin, before they went on a spree of killing kids and civilians in the Palestinian villages, the Israeli government had decided, and the Israeli embassies carried this out, to go on a big offensive against anti-Semitism, to put all those who try and defend Palestine on the defensive. Well, some of us will not go on the defensive. And I just say, we don't need to be on the defensive, because the Palestinians have become the indirect victims of the European Judeo side of the Second World War. That's the truth of the matter. That's what's happened. Think about it. Why are the Palestinians to blame? They didn't do anything. What did they do? They were living in their lands and were booted off, ethnically cleansed, killed, villages destroyed. And many Israeli historians now write about this. Benny Morris, great revisionist historian, I don't agree with him, but at least he tells the truth. He says, yeah, we drove them out. We raped their women. I've seen it all in the Israeli archives. Yes, Arab women were raped by Israeli soldiers. It's painful to some people, but it happened. And unless you acknowledge what you did to them, how can you have any reconciliation? And it wasn't their fault. It was so-called European civilization which presided over the massacre of Jews. Christian civilization. That's what did it. Historically, Islamic civilization and Judaic civilization have been close with each other, to each other, till 1948. You go back and look at the history, they often fought together against the Crusaders. They suffered together against the Inquisition and the reconquest of Islamic Spain, Al-Andalus. It's still only in 1948 that this problem began. And it's a tragedy that it's the Palestinians and the Arabs who are blamed for the anti-Semitism which actually led to the destruction of 5-6 million Jews during the Second World War. And many of the governments who are today supporting Israel, the United States and Britain in particular, turned back ships carrying Jewish refugees from Germany. They did that too. So they have their bad consciences. We understand that. But these bad consciences shouldn't make them indifferent to Palestinian suffering today. That too is what is going on. And as long as these conditions exist, the occupation of Iraq, the mess, the tragedy of Palestine, you will not get any lasting peace. That is the history of that region and other regions. And how could you get it? Be impossible to demand that. Think if Western countries were in a similar situation. No one would demand it of them. So it can't be demanded of the Iraqis or the Palestinians unless there is a serious attempt to reach a political settlement. And that is something we have to carry on fighting for.